Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Platinum VIP Terminal. Experience private check-in, suites for relaxation, and then chauffeur-driven to your aircraft.
Welcome to Playback. What a wet, wet month it has been. And when Storm Chandra landed, it was onto sodden ground.
21 days of rain and 25 days of January, the conditions were there for flooding.
Yeah, exactly.
The ground just couldn't absorb
anymore.
It's been
raining pretty much continuously. For example, Johnstown Castle, one of Met Aaron's stations in County Wexford, recorded rain on 15 consecutive days. So it's rained every day since Tuesday the 13th of January. So it's just been a steady accumulation of rain over a prolonged period of time. And it was just tipped over the edge with the added rain, heavy rainfall overnight and into this morning.
Lindy Hughes of Met Aaron on Tuesday's Drive Time. Tipped over the edge, that's for sure. And across all programmes this week, we heard from people whose lives, homes and businesses had been devastated by the flooding.
The place is just absolutely, as you can see, the place is just destroyed. We weren't expecting it. The water was 6 inches into the door there. You could not walk out here, you'd be swept away. 3 foot of water there, yeah, and flowing hard.
So it actually came in our back door before it came in the front door. But then before it came in the front door, it actually came up to the foundation of the house. So we got it in every room. Or the kitchen was destroyed. And then it was in the sitting room. Timber floors are destroyed. We'd only got down at Christmas. And the bedrooms, so it came into the whole house.
I came to work this morning at 5:15 in my car, and when I got to the new apartments here, my car floated from there down to there. You can see the white car, that white Passat, that's mine. So it's been there since 5:30 this morning in the water.
That must have been frightening for you.
It was very frightening because the water came up to my window. I had to get out of the passenger window to get out of the car because I couldn't open the doors because the water was up so high. So
the call around 6 o'clock this morning, when it started coming into our premises and people's business on the Island Road and on Temple Shannon, we just start going in as hard as we can and seeing could we do anything, but really it just came in very quickly. There's a lot of heavy machinery in the tyre centre, tyre machines, wheel balancers, alignment systems, you know, more or less, like I said, are destroyed. I had teleporters in there, I had forklifts in there, the water, we couldn't get them out. Bad enough, my business, you know, whatever, look, I can go home, I'm home here now after hopping in the shower, things like that, but there's people who have nowhere to live now down on the Island Road. Been taken out by boats from the second floor of their windows.
Last night, my 3-week-old grandson, he was a little bit upset, so his mummy rang me to go down and help him. Baby walked in about 5 o'clock for a bottle, and I looked out the window and we were absolutely completely trapped in. We were on the first level. The water was coming in at the ground floor door, so we gathered everything. They said they would send an empty boat. Slaney Rescue were amazing. They put me into the boat first and then handed me the baby. I held on to the baby while my daughter Casey got in next, and Stephen held both of us in. It was scary.
And how was the baby through all of this? Was he sleeping?
He slept the whole way through it.
These houses are opposite the Dodder River. I'm standing in front of a housing estate and the water is flowing like a river in front of me.
It just got worse and worse. I thought it would have went away. The rain stopped and it just got worse. It was really crazy weather. Put all the towels, and all the towels I had and bedclothes still got come in. The carpet is all wringing wet, you know, wringing wet. You just have to let things dry out. It's like a man being on the beer when he's trying to dry out, you know.
By the time I got to the garage, it was under 8 foot of water. All the customers' cars, all my own cars, my dad's cars, they all got destroyed. Going from experience, because this happened in 2014, by the time we open up, we'd be left with just 4 blank walls. All our equipment will have to be thrown out. All our Don Oscar's computers will have to be thrown out as well. Now, the insurance companies will not give us insurance anymore in the garage for flooding.
How did you feel when you went down yesterday morning and saw all the water?
To be honest with you, I just start crying. It means a lot to me since my dad started it up 48 years ago, and I had to go and tell the man that his business is gone again. It kills me to tell him that.
We're absolutely devastated. Our houses are absolutely destroyed. The whole street has had to evacuate. It was a derelict house. We worked extremely hard to renovate it. We were so proud of our house, and now it's all gone.
Well, the basic thing you'd be expecting is sandbags. So, like, if they didn't even foresee that they'd need those for Bunclody, or is it just that they don't care about Bunclody? That's what it feels like.
We could have been helped more. and we weren't helped at all. When they did start coming with a few sandbags, most of them we filled ourselves. It was too little too late.
Just some of the voices on the radio this week in the immediate aftermath of Storm Chandra. And yesterday, the East braced itself for yet more rain. Eddie Taff, CEO of Wexford County Council, joined Sarah.
And if there is further flooding today, will people be more prepared or more able to prevent damage?
Well, yes, we've distributed, and we had distributed in advance of the flood on Tuesday, sandbags. So far, we've distributed about 10,000 sandbags in the Enniscorthy and Buncloddy areas. So we are on the ground. We were on the ground since last Saturday, actually, because we've had very high levels in the Slaney since Saturday of last week. But we are on the ground. We are in discussions with Met Éireann, and we're monitoring river levels.
And all of this against the backdrop of flooding on the M50, traffic in gridlock and public transport ground to a halt because of the weather. And it did seem that all of this had taken many by surprise. And very quickly, questions were being asked about who knew what, when. On Wednesday's Morning Ireland, Justin put this to Keith Lamkin, Head of Climate Services with Met Éireann.
Was the warning system adequate or was the warning system inadequate yesterday?
Yeah, so good morning. The warnings that were out were for rainfall and they largely targeted the southeast and east of the country. And they cover a particular amount of rainfall that's expected to fall. Now, looking at the rain that actually fell over the course of the country, generally speaking, looking at a map of the country, the warnings did cover, generally speaking, the region and also the amounts that fell. There were areas that kind of spiked. The difficulty came from was that rainfall that fell within Storm Chandra yesterday, it fell on top of extremely saturated soil. We were under fairly unusual conditions, not necessarily from Ireland, but certainly from that region. And it was really a question of not necessarily the amount of rain that fell, but where it actually fell. Mm.
So a lot of rain on already wet ground, but as you can hear, Justin pushed a bit more.
Professor Mary Burke, the Professor of Geography at TCD, points out in the Irish Times this morning that people who were badly affected, that they, you know, there was a yellow weather warning, but some people experienced orange or red warning conditions. And she said that those people got no notice that the rivers were going to flood. Was data available yesterday which could have warned people that the rivers in their areas were about to flood?
There's, at the moment, Ireland are putting together a flood warning system. The Met Éireann rain warnings would be separate to that. They would feed into a wider system. That system itself then, based on the amount of rain that was expected and the known fact that it was saturated levels, the local authorities and so forth would have been warned of the likes of localised flooding and many actors on the basis of that. What other jurisdictions have is a more complicated, better observation system that then feeds higher resolution models that then feeds into a warning system. Ireland are currently in the process of putting that system in place, but only components of that are in there at the moment. That's still in development.
Okay, and when will we have it?
Well, Met Éireann is one of the players embedded in that with many others working under the Office of Emergency Management. So that's a process that's in place. Typically in other jurisdictions, that's going to take up to 20 years. At the moment, Ireland are in that first kind of half of that cycle. So it's still something that's in development, but it's not something that's available overnight. There are many complicated components embedded in that the government are actively working on.
However, also on Wednesday, Wexford Housing Minister James Brown had some hard questions for Met Éireann. Here he is speaking to South East Radio.
I'm really frustrated that some state agencies seem to think that it's, you know, their duty to somehow withhold information. I'm a great believer in information should be out there. I don't know whether there was a possibility of an earlier warning in this particular situation, and I let Met Éireann defend themselves in that respect if they can. But what I will say is, in general, I think Met Éireann do have to step up their communications.
Will you, in your role as minister, will you question Met Éireann?
Oh, absolutely.
And ask them for a response?
I think we'd be doing more than that. I think we would be bringing Met Éireann in and say that, look, there needs to be an understanding here that information is not to be guarded. Information is to be put out there, and we need to do a much better job of communications. But also what we've asked Met Éireann to do as well, is to look at how they bring these warnings, you know, yellow, orange, red warnings. It's based on a mathematical formula, whereas in other countries they use the mathematical formula, but then they also make a judgment call. And I think there needs to be a greater use of that judgment call as well, I think, in terms of being able to warn people what is coming down the line.
Well, later that afternoon, Liveline got into it.
James Brown very much has Met Éireann in his crosshairs when he looks upon those devastating scenes in his own hometown of Enniscorthy. Kevin Tyrrell is on the line. Kevin, is the minister right?
Hi, Kieran. I don't believe so. This is, to me, is just scapegoating. I was thinking about this whole thing earlier, and I fashioned this almost like, you know, the old sea captain who can stand by the sea and sniff the wind and see, you know, like, oh, there's a storm going to come at such and such a time. You know, we people in Enniscorthy have been going through this since the year 2000. So it's 25 years now ongoing that, you know, we've been experiencing flooding. We know when a flood is going to happen. We know that after a week of rain and with a storm on the horizon, it's batten down the hatches. We're not idiots. We don't need Met Éireann to tell us, you know, like, that this is going to happen. We know it's going to happen.
But how aware were Wexford County Council that this might be on the cards? Back to Eddie Taff.
Mr. Brown criticised Met Éireann for, as he put it, guarding information about what was coming. But Met Éireann has said that it flagged a high likelihood of this flooding with the National Emergency Coordination Group on Monday. Were you told by the National Emergency Coordination Group on Monday that there was a high risk of flooding in parts of Leinster?
Yeah, we were aware at that briefing that and Met Éireann were very clear in that while the rainfall levels were, shall we say, in the yellow range, that because groundwater, because the ground was saturated from accumulated rain, that the relatively small amounts of rainfall would have an exaggerated effect on river levels. And that's why we had been monitoring the Slaney from Saturday, as I said before, okay, even before those briefings. So we don't rely on one single source of information. We heard that message from Met Éireann. We had mobilised on Saturday, but we also look at the OPW river gauges to assess what's actually happening in the Slaney catchment based on the rainfall.
And for those whose houses and businesses are underwater, can they even claim on their insurance? Kind of unlikely. On Drive Time, here's Jonathan Hare of insuremyhouse.ie.
What in general is the insurance industry's stance on flood cover, especially when it comes to an extreme storm like the one we've just seen?
Some people who flooded yesterday will be covered and they will be thanking their lucky stars. But the unfortunate position they're in is that most likely this is the last time they will have flood cover, because once the insurance companies have been bitten, a lot of them will tend not to insure you going forward for flood. And it won't be just the insurance company that paid your flood claim. The rest of them will now have updated their flood maps to show that you're in a particular area and they won't pay a claim going forward. People who've had flood previously, they don't have any cover today. They're the really unlucky ones. And they are now looking at the costs themselves, and they will have to try to go through the humanitarian scheme, which won't cover them for everything that an insurance policy would.
And the UK has a dedicated national insurance fund to help with flood claims. Do we have anything similar here, or how does that work?
No, we don't. We should. Every year we leave victims of flood to their own devices. We talk about it for a few days. The water goes away and the people who are left with the catastrophic damage have to deal with it. And we don't really do anything for them, and we should. And it's a shame we don't do it.
And as Met Éireann issued ever more status yellow rain warnings, more questions about the need for flood defences and better and more robust public transport options. Our climate emergency is coming to our doors, quite literally in some cases, and we need to prepare for more of this. Here's John Sweeney, climatologist at NUI Maynooth.
In all of the infrastructure planning that's going on at the moment, how much is that kind of climate proofing built into it?
It is to some extent, but I would say not to a sufficiently high degree. Most of the major flood relief schemes have typically been designed around protecting against a once-in-a-100-year event, and even coastal areas maybe once-in-a-200-year event. But those concepts are now obsolete. We can't really design schemes on the basis of a climate that has now changed. So we have to be even more conscious of the fact that areas which never flooded will start flooding now in the years ahead. Areas which flooded infrequently will start flooding more frequently. It's now 20 years since the first scenarios of rainfall change in Ireland were developed. I know because I was involved in it. And we knew then that winter rainfall was going to increase, and it has increased by 7%. So we've had time to prepare. And yet it's quite true that we haven't really developed adaptation for our flood protections as appropriate to that kind of knowledge over the past 20 okay. years. We do need the hard engineering solutions in some places, but we need to look at other more radical solutions, such as letting places flood higher upstream, going down the road the Dutch have gone for making room for the river to protect our towns and cities by allowing floodplains higher up, okay. maybe even paying our farmers to do that kind of service for us.
In the meantime, let's just hope the rain eases off. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Dermot's in for Oliver and of a wet Monday. They went for comedy, all praise. Via the stage, mind you, Killian Sunderman and Sive McLaughlin are acting in what are called 24-hour plays. But you might know them better from stand-up.
Killian, your poor dad has, you know, gotten a hard time because he's of German origin.
Yeah.
And you enjoy, I guess, tapping into him to produce mm-hmm. some of your comedy content.
Yeah, to the extent where when I was I'm doing my second tour at the moment, and my dad was like, please don't put me in the next show.
So you didn't put him in the show, but maybe I'll go on the Late Show and about him there. Let's have a listen.
But like he tries to give me jokes all the time. Like the other day he's like, Killian, I've got a really good joke for you. So I was listening to the radio, yeah, and talking about the AirPods. And they're saying the AirPods are so crazy at the moment. They're calling Joe. They're going, oh, Joe, the AirPods are so crazy.
Yeah, so you can have that joke.
And for Sive, well, it's accents.
I'm so excited to share with you my brand new course, How to Become the Best Version of Yourself This Year and Never Look Back and Have the Ultimate Glow Up and Be Really Pretty and Skinny and Most Importantly, Connect with Nature. So comment below, Best Version of Me, and join my course this year for just $996 a week.
And as a quiet kid, she got into stand-up almost by accident.
When was your first stand-up gig?
My first stand-up gig was a gong show. Now, I didn't know what that was. I did it in London, and a gong show. So I arrived to the gig and then the MC had interesting energy about him. And then he went on stage and he said, okay, so I'm going to pick three judges in the audience. And if you don't like the comedian, raise your glass. If three people raise their glass, you're off. So it straight away set up this horrible, like, gladiator atmosphere of the audience being like, go on, try and make me laugh.
They could just be signaling to the barman, like, another one, please.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
No. And
so you get kicked off stage. I'm like, okay, sorry. I'm so sorry. So that was my first experience. And then I took I was like, nah, it's not for me. And then I got back into it in October, was like, okay, let's give this a proper go. And it's awful. It's really awful. But then there's something about, like, I'll be like, I can't do this anymore. And then the next day I'm like, all right, let's book some more gigs. You know what I mean? And I don't know.
That's welcome to a sickness.
Yeah, it is. It feels like an awful, like, toxic relationship, you know?
I know. I remember.
And that brings us here.
I got told before we started the interview, this is a culture show. So I already feel improved. I feel like an advert for comprehensive education being on it.
Well, let's wait and see how this goes, first of all.
That's John Bishop on The Culture Show, sorry, Arena. And he was talking to Rick about Is This Thing On? A new film telling the story of a stand-up comedian. It stars Will Arnett, Laura Dern, and is directed by no less than Bradley Cooper. And it's based on Bishop's life.
People probably know the story already, but just remind us again of that story of what happened that very first night that you ended up in a comedy club.
Well, the very potted story is me and my wife had split up, and I couldn't have the kids in the week because of the nature of my job. I couldn't guarantee when I would be at home, but I had them every weekend. So I had them Friday to Monday. So every Monday I dropped them off, which meant every Monday I was on a downer. So I was looking for something to do on a Monday night to cheer myself up. I walked past this comedy club called The Frog and Bucket in Manchester. I had no interest in stand-up comedy. I was a month away from being 34. And I'd been to two comedy clubs in my whole life. But I just thought, I'll go in because someone will cheer me up and it'll be a laugh. And the guy on the door said, it's £4 to get in unless you put your name down. And I said, well, put my name down for what? And he said, it's an open mic night. So I didn't know what that meant. So he said, that means if your name gets called out, you've got to go on stage, but it also means you don't have to pay the £4. And, you know, I was getting divorced, so I thought, well, that's £4 she's not getting. So I put my name down, expecting there's going to be at least 100 people in there. I walked in and there was 7. And I got called out second, and I go on stage. I fell in love with it. But I didn't tell anyone. I kept it to myself. And then the, you know, the Hollywood moment in the film that really drives the story is the real thing that happened. My wife ended up coming, not knowing I did stand-up comedy, sitting in the audience while I tell jokes about it. And then we started talking afterwards and then ended up getting back together.
And this is a story that doesn't really end with the happy ever after. In fact, it delves into the real and sometimes messy story of a long-term relationship.
Hollywood films are about that first flush. They're about people falling in love for the first time. They're about that part of a relationship. There are so few of them that are about what happened to you, that ending up separating from someone, but then coming back together, and particularly through comedy of all things. I mean, that's really unusual.
You know, it's not a film about comedy. It's a film about love, and it's a film about adult love or authentic relationships, where there's a line in the film which I might slightly misquote, but I think sums the whole thing up, where he says, you know, I wasn't unhappy with our marriage, I was unhappy in our marriage. And that sums up what so many people are living. You know, it's this idea that, yeah, on Christmas Day, everyone dresses in the same pyjamas and takes a photograph and wear a... No family's like that. The truth is, marriage is hard work, families are hard work, things are complicated, but, you know, if the love's strong enough, it's worth fighting for.
So, given that it is such a personal story, how does it feel watching it get the full-on Hollywood treatment?
We just sat there, there was me and Melanie, thinking, we don't know what this is going to be like. You know, just holding hands, and that was emotional, because Melanie summed it up perfectly. She said, we've handed over something so precious, and the people we gave it to held on to it and treated it perfectly well. And I couldn't have asked for it to be better.
Oh, now isn't that just lovely? However, you know what wasn't so lovely? Dating stories on Liveline. Yeah, it's a minefield. Or at least it can be. The swiping, the ghosting, the breadcrumbing, and now the slow fade. And if you don't know what any of those terms mean, well, lucky you.
Like, I've had friends left at the airport on the way to a holiday and the guy hasn't turned up.
Amy, stop.
No,
what?
Genuinely, I've had
Where
friends
were they going?
At a wedding in Spain.
And she was at the airport waiting for him to arrive.
And, like, boarded and was like, what do I do? I'll just go on my holiday then.
And did she go on her holiday?
She went on her holiday, yeah.
And any word from him?
Nope.
Sorry, he just totally ghosted her.
You're calling them, blocked her. I've had friends who've gone sail, agreed with men, and they've left. I don't want to do this anymore. Gone. I've had friends who've started to live with someone. Gone. Just walked out the door. We just, like, it goes from the very minimal stuff of, like, a ghost after a couple of dates or whatever to really hurting people. And it just seems to be so, like, devious. It's cruel and, yeah. You know, so
but why wouldn't he just go on the holiday and then break up?
I don't know. You'd have to ask him. She didn't get any answers either. Like, we're just not getting any clear answers.
But Amy, you must have...
That's Amy. She'd started the ball rolling. She and her friends were at the end of their tether, swiping, dating, and then meeting well men who, to put it politely, did not seem to be on the same page.
Like a lot of my friends in their mid-30s, they are dating to find someone to marry, and she wants children. A lot of my friends want children. And I suppose if, you know, being very clear with them and asking them if that's not what you're dating for, and if you want something more casual, I'm not the girl for you. And yet these men seem to just carry on and date them and giving them a lot of false hope. And then just ghost. And I suppose in this case and a lot of cases, it's more about this new thing they're calling online the slow fade, where
what's that?
You know, the like the communication kind of changes, it drops off. They might be texting and calling you all the time, and then all of a sudden they're not texting back for hours at a time, or you might just get the one tick, so you're like, God, have I been blocked? Or they just turned off their phone. Or even just asking clear questions about are they seeing other people and being fobbed off with that as well. And, you know, it's just so hurtful.
So not so much a case of what do women want, they're telling you. But for Amy and other callers to Liveline, the men, not so straight talking. In short,
what is the point? What are they doing? Are they doing a bit of an experiment on trying to figure out what they want? I would assume if you wanted to figure that out, go to therapy and figure that out, leave me alone. I just, yeah, it's just something we were thinking about.
Putting it up to the men of Ireland, or at least those who phoned in. Here's Patrick.
I don't think a man settles down until he's about 40. I mean, he has an awful lot of things to work out. His career, he has to find out about his income. Has he enough to buy a house, to keep it going, to start a family, to get married? He knows that a woman around 30 is under the biological clock pressure, and that puts pressure on him to settle maybe when he's not ready. A lot of men like to look around at the field of what's going on through their 30s until they're in a position, a stronger position to settle, which usually happens about 40, I think.
So bide your time. And then we had Michael. He's in his 30s now, but he did say that in his 20s he was not the man he is today. And he gave us this choice anecdote against himself, in fairness.
I remember one time she came home, she had done a really long shift at work, right? And she said, oh, I just feel like crap. I've worked such long hours. It's been a week of doing this. I just feel terrible. I said to her, yeah, well, you know, a lot of people work long hours, you know.
Oh, so, Michael! You
know, yes, exactly, exactly. And she said to me, you know what, all I wanted was for you to say to me, that is crap. You know, that is really crap. And validate her emotions and validate her feelings, right? And it was like a light bulb turned over my head, right? And this is like simple stuff, right? Like simple empathy. But I'm going to say this is the turning point for me to be able to be like, right, this is a person, right? Not that I didn't think she was a person before, but this is a person with emotional needs and just who just wanted to be validated, all right?
Just about made it out of that one alive, Michael. That was Tuesday, but my Wednesday, well, Manon and Heron were on fire. Take it away, Lisa.
No, I'm only on the apps with a month, and it's a month too long.
Oh, go
and
away.
What I mean,
go on, tell
me.
Why? What's been 100%. Happening?
I have to laugh. There's guys on it and they're looking for short-term fun, and then you'll see down on their profile is they're still figuring it out at 48 years of age. What are you figuring out? Where you're going to be buried? You know, at 48 years of age. 48 years of age, you should know what you want in your life. But I think a lot of these guys, they're only jumping from one woman to the other, and when does any responsibility or
See,
any
I think
respect said,
well,
look
I,
for?
I got to defend men here. I think men are just more open-minded and open to change. In that sense, they're still figuring things out,
I
you
think
know?
What's wrong is that men want everything done for them, and when women start putting in boundaries and saying, this is the way it should be. My idea is that I give 100% respect to anybody, but I think with guys, like you've just discussed, is the fact of guys will go along with you where they're getting what they want, and the minute then they'll think that you're getting too clingy or you're looking for too much. Looking for a babysitter, they're looking.
Scorchio. Also on the line, Caro.
I just found yesterday I was getting so frustrated hearing some of the excuses that are continuously put up for men, almost like infantilizing them a little bit. Like they feel too much pressure to cope with the demands of being in a committed relationship, or they need that time to become financially dependent, I think one gentleman said.
Yeah.
And I think we're past that point as women. We want these men to be partners with us, and we're just finding that they're lacking.
And if you were a man listening to this fuming, well, fear not. Tina had your back.
Why do you think men and women are on different wavelengths when it comes to dating in their 30s?
I'm kind of on the guy's side a little bit here. Men and women are different, and that's never going to change. What I noted from the calls yesterday was a kind of CV spreadsheet of their wants and their needs on their first date. So they've gone out and they're saying, I want to be honest, I want to be up front with you. I'm, you know, I feel my clock is ticking. I want to settle down. I want to have a family. I want to buy a house. And do you not think that's scaring somebody off? Where's the romance? Where's the fun? Where's the enjoying yourself and getting to know one another? You're putting an awful lot of pressure on these lads to be a baby maker, a provider.
Yeah.
You know, they're looking for lads to... Are they looking for lads to match that money purely to provide them with what they want?
Last word on this to Lisa.
Lisa, do you think you're putting men under too much pressure?
No, definitely not. I already have my own house. I have a good job. I already have a good car. I'm not putting pressure on nobody. All I'm looking for somebody, as they say, what do you bring to the table? I bring the bloody table. I think it's the women that are bringing everything to the table.
Do you think maybe men just get spooked by talk of commitment too early? You know, it's not really our fault. It's actually a quirk of evolution. You know, go forth and multiply. You know, that's it. I wish we could be better people, but that's just the way we've evolved.
Ooh, tongue firmly lodged in cheek there, Cudahy. We can only assume it is indeed a jungle out there. Back in a bit. Welcome back and listen up.
When a sound is very quiet, you have to trust the sound. So it can't go loud.
Oh, the Culture File debate on Lyric. And Luke Clancy was all about the quiet and the loud. But for composer John Godfrey, if you want someone to listen, go quiet.
You mentioned earlier the idea of piano and forte in music as being possibly just simply other ways of manipulating attention. And for me, I think the essence of quietness is that it invites attention rather than manipulates it. And the thing is that the quiet is actually a very complex concept. It's not just about a low level of noise. I think there are plenty of other places where we routinely use the word quiet. We talk about quiet spaces, and we don't necessarily mean a space that is quiet in volume. Sometimes we are simply talking about a space of time or a room that is relatively free of stress, of things pulling at you. It's a time that we can think about not necessarily even contemplation, but simply being within ourselves and not feeling pulled at by the rest of the world. There's that aspect. I think also there's the aspect of what happens to our hearing, to our perception, when volumes become very low. And that really fascinates me more and more, because something extremely interesting happens right on the edge of hearing. Now, I mean, that we know that. It's a rhetorical device because, you know, you can make your point by banging the table and shouting, or you can make your point by actually becoming sparser and quiet. the thing is that our attention does something very interesting when that happens, and we start to go out to it. Now, for me, that feels very different to the sensation when volume is above a certain level and you are now receiving it. It's playing at you. And I don't necessarily mean that as an aggressive thing. I simply mean that you are in a position of receiving, and then the volume goes up and up and up, and after a certain time, you are riding a wild horse. The sort of the experience is being given to you by the sound, and there's very little of yourself in that.
John Godfrey on Culture File, bringing us to this. Computer on, phone charged, time to watch telly. And all of this has a name.
Sonic branding is the strategic use of sound to create a distinct identity for a brand. But kind of in layman's terms, it's basically what a brand sounds like, or what an organization sounds like. In a similar way to the visual identity being how a brand looks, or, you know, a sonic identity is how it sounds.
Not just a bit of binging and boring. That's Keith Lawler, creative director of Loud House, and he is a sonic consultant for Yes, Such a Thing Exists.
I think everybody, when they heard the Netflix sonic brand going there, was probably going, oh, is it time for to watch the telly?
Well, not right now, David. Shh.
Yeah, they're incredibly powerful, and sound could be so powerful in such even a small snippet like that. You know, you could be in the kitchen making dinner, and next thing you hear the boom in the background, and you instantly there's something triggered inside you to go, okay, now it's time to either hurry up making this dinner and get in and enjoy Netflix. But it does something to us emotionally, and it's the Sonic logo. I like to describe it in terms of like the Sonic, a Sonic brand or a Sonic theme and a Sonic logo. Or it's like the hook in a song that you use to describe the song. So like, think of Under Pressure by Queen, where it's just all you need to hear is pressure, and then you know the whole song, and you know it's Queen, and everything that is associated with the brand Queen. That 1 second and that one sound is enough to make you recognize that and make you feel something about it.
DMC and the Sonic branding. Interesting, here on Team Playback, a fearful gulp. Now to Saturday with Brendan, and in their Life in Five Songs slot, Bob Geldof. He's doing some gigs.
When you started playing again, I thought, well, you know, Geldof's loaded, he's doing the other lads a favour. And then I went to see, it was in the Marquee in Cork, probably about 10 years ago or more, and I saw it, and I realised, no, they're doing him a favour. He needs this.
That's a very great insight.
need to keep doing it, don't you?
I can't tell you how brilliant it was. I mean, just the band, I don't know, you know, just brilliant. I just, you know, they just went nuts, the crowd. I mean nuts. Yeah, I mean, see, the thing is, I could chat to you now at the side of the stage, like, Bob, you're on, and suddenly, literally like that, I start going nuts. And I don't stop until the show's over. I don't stop. I don't want intros. I don't want anything. Go.
Go is right. And for almost an hour, Bob Geldof was funny, frank, and at times heartbreaking in his honesty. And if you missed the whole thing live, listen back. You will not regret it. But there was one particular question and answer that might just stop you in your tracks.
Can I ask you? I ask you this not in the interest of grief porn, but because I think you are extremely articulate about this, and I think it is helpful to people that you have known unimaginable grief in your life, starting with your mum, then a bad split from Paula, her tragic death, and then, unbelievably, your daughter Peaches. Does it take a lot of defiance to prevent your whole life being defined by that grief?
God, Brendan, shut up. Leave me alone. It's not defined by it. I mean, it's a very difficult question.
But he did talk very generously about his loss and spoke to Brendan about his mother, who had died when he was very small.
The young Bob just got on with it. The night before my mum died, I don't really remember her. Memory is, and forgive this sort of pseudo, memory is Proustian, you know. There's a jigsaw moments that you piece together to form a picture. And for me, my mum is lipstick on a china teacup, an arm with a glamorous evening gown glove, black glove up past her elbows. Me, I think, seeing legs pedaling on a Singer sewing machine. I must have been underneath the sewing machine. And there's a couple of other things. And these jigsaw moments piece together a sense of my mum, a sense of her. I can't, and you have no need to, conjure her up.
And when his ex-wife, Paula Yates, died, he drew on his own mother's death and his father's honesty in telling his own children what had happened.
When Paula died, all of this was very useful. And I remembered the directness of my father, and that's precisely what a child needs. Tell me exactly. Okay. No obfuscations. And when I had to tell my children, it was terrible. I got a phone call, and it was Pixie's 10th birthday that day. And the other two girls were there and excited. And Pixie was all dressed up. She was going over to have lunch with her mum. We were divorced then. And I put down the phone as if it was just a phone call. And Fifi, 11 or I don't know what age she was, maybe 14, she said, "What? Don't tell me, mum, whatever, something, something." And I said, no. I said, "Go on, open your presents, stop messing around." And I went down the hall and I said to Jean, I told her, I said, "Paul has just died." And she just stared at me. And then I said, I don't know what to do. And then I just left the room and I just went up and I just said, "Okay." And I did what my father did. And they reacted differently. I think I failed, actually, Brendan. I think I didn't do it right. That's bugged me subsequently. I brought them to see her body, which is the thing you do now, you're advised to do. Mm-hmm. And they didn't really, they saw it as an inert thing.
Yeah.
Mum wasn't there. And unlike me, they got to understand, okay. Especially Tiger, she got to understand, you know, her mum had gone and understood the logic of life and death.
And he described his own complicated feelings after Paula had died.
The grief, the agony was not as bad as when Paula left me. That was worse.
Okay.
And that required something else in me. And honest to God, I just didn't want to wake up again. And, you know, you deal with these chasms of grief, these universes of loss, these abysses of pain, and not understanding anything. But I come back to my point. Your soul cannot continue. If you make the decision, I'm going to live because I have children and I'm going to make sure they're okay. If you make that decision, the soul has no proposition except to bind itself together, to somehow push itself back, this obliterated thing. And the only way to do that is somehow through love. And I didn't want to see another woman in my life. I hated every woman. And whether I liked it or not, it took a while, but my soul demanded love. And it came to me, and I was unwilling, and I resisted, never again, because I will not survive again. Mm. I resisted, but you have no choice. You know, allow it in, and once it weasels its way in, you begin to be less hateful as a person. You begin to bind again, and you become human again. And that's essentially what happened. And
he talked about his daughter, Peaches, who died in 2014. And in his own words, grief erupts.
Been stopped at traffic lights, for example. This happened the other day. And suddenly Peaches was there. She was with me. And I wept. And being me, you're a bit afraid that the guy in the next car doesn't see you and take a picture of you and all that stuff. So you have to be careful. But I wasn't really aware I was weeping. I wasn't sobbing, just tears as she was there. And so all of these things I picture as like a memory stick, you know, for your laptop or something.
Yeah.
And it's exactly that rectangular shape. And in that is all the memory, all the grief, all the pain, all the loss, all of that. And I stick that in an available compartment of my head. And when it erupts as it does, unbeckoned, unbidden, at a traffic light stop, I can see it, I can take it out, and I say, "I know you, you little fucker. get back where you belong. And that's how I deal with it. It gets contained.
And this is how the interview finished up.
Look, how many people are listening to this show that go through exactly the same thing? And I don't want to sound like a hippie. I don't want to sound like anything. All I know is that I haven't, sterile old me, I haven't quite understood how much I loved, how much I'd been loved. And as the poet Larkin says, all that remains of us will be love. That's true. But it takes this 74-year-old geezer. How long and what experience did I need to go through to understand that it is the central, foundational, spinal thing of life is love?
And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week, and we will finish with this music choice from Bob Geldof.
Hope it don't rain all day. And it's stung me till my soul